Welcome to the President's Inbox, a CFR podcast about the foreign policy challenges facing the United States. I'm Jim Lindsay, Director of Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. This week's topic is Power in Asia. With me to discuss how political and economic influence is shifting among states in Asia is Hervé Lamayou. Hervé is the director of the Asian Power and Diplomacy Program at the Lowy Institute in Sydney. He is responsible for the production of the Institute's annual Asia Power Index, a data-driven assessment that maps the changing distribution of power in Asia. Hervé, thanks for being here.
Thanks very much for having me back on your show, Jim.
At the top, Hervé, I want to point out that you do not sound like Keith Urban or Jim Jeffries or any of the Hemsworth brothers. So maybe if you could sort of explain to people why it is you don't sound like you just came off a beach in Sydney, even though you're in Sydney.
Look, I'm still working on it 4 years in. Unfortunately, you know, the European in me has left a pronounced impact. But my short story is that I'm originally from Belgium. I was born in Bruges. I grew up in different countries, including in Southeast Asia, in Myanmar or Burma. And I arrived as a Brexit refugee, having spent 10 years in the UK. I arrived in Australia in 2016. And the rest is history, really. I'm a permanent resident now on my way to citizenship. And Australia is a very diverse, cosmopolitan society, and they've found place for me.
It certainly is, and Australia is lucky to have you, but enough about the demographics and the history. Let's talk about the Asia Power Index. What exactly is it?
It's a very comprehensive exercise that we undertake annually. We've been doing it since 2018, where we try to put some empirical evidence behind what everyone always talks about, which is the changing balance of power between the United States and China, but beyond that, between 26 countries that really make up and sustain the Indo-Pacific or Asia-Pacific ecosystem, because ultimately, it's not just the actions of the United States and China that count. It's a multitude of other players and the way in which they interact and align with each other. So we take a very broad view of power. We interpret that to mean the ability of countries to shape their external environment, to influence the course of international and regional events, and as well to influence the behavior of state actors and non-state actors. And that really relies on a number of dimensions. It's not just military capability. It's not even just economic resources. But it's we make that distinction between what countries have in terms of their resources and capabilities, and what countries choose to do with what they have in terms of the influence-based determinants of power, whether that's diplomatic, cultural, economic diplomacy, you name it. So we have 8 core measures of power, 128 indicators, 30,000 data points, and the 2020 edition, which covers 3 years of data, is the most comprehensive assessment of the changing distribution of power in Asia so far.
Before we plunge into the actual construction of the index, what are you hoping that people who look at the index take away from it? And I should point out that people who want to explore the index can go to the Lowy Institute's website to see the index. But what is sort of the rationale for putting this together? What is it you want people to take away?
Well, firstly, it comes back to that point that geopolitics is more than just superpower rivalry, that there are a host of other players, including Australia and a number of other middle powers that do play a consequential role in the region. So we need to broaden the scope of our analysis. Secondly, that power is often multidimensional, that we have this over-reliance historically on choosing one indicator, one proxy for power. And, you know, that's varied over the years. It used to be things like coal and steel production during the early Cold War days, where we thought that we could assess the Soviet Union's power on that basis. Obviously, the space race and then, you know, the nuclear weapons and then GDP now, I think, since the end of the Cold War has become the go-to proxy for power. And I think there's nothing wrong with GDP, but it is just one dimension of a much more complicated picture. So what we've tried to do is break down the various dimensions of power, show you how countries have pronounced strengths and weaknesses, and how one thing interacts with the other. So for example, how the rise of China as a military power, how its assertiveness actually creates unintended consequences in terms of other countries banding together in terms of deepening their defense partnerships in an effort to create a counterweight. So doing one thing, applying your power in one area often has a multitude of consequences in other areas. And this is what we are tracking.
Well, let's talk then about the findings of the index. What are the top line conclusions coming out of the 2020 edition of the Asia Power Index?
The pandemic has clearly affected dynamics dynamics within the region and globally. It's accelerated a redistribution of global economic power between the United States and China, but it has also, I think, triggered a bit of a race to the bottom within Asia. And that might seem surprising given that as a region, a lot of the success stories in terms of the handling of the health pandemic come from this region, whether that's Southeast Asia or South Korea or New Zealand and Australia. As a region, I think we've done better than Europe or the United States. However, we've not been immune to the economic consequences, the fallout of the pandemic. And that really has triggered a race to the bottom, is how we describe it, where countries have competed with each other only by degrees of underperformance. So 18 countries, the vast majority of those that we look at, registered sharp downward shifts in their relative power in 2020. And this is a remarkable turn of fortunes for what has been a very successful Asian century to date. I mean, the region is obviously very contested, but it is also a far more prosperous region. Asia's economic transformation is at the heart of what's driving geopolitics, but also has resulted in a far more a prosperous region. But 2020 has marked a real shift in the overall narrative that may well change again, but it is interesting. Before I move into some concrete findings of 2020, I think I wanted to share with you some three overarching trends that we've picked up over the course of doing this exercise for 3 years.
Tell us about it.
What one is I think it's apparent to us that we're rapidly approaching a point of convergence between China and the United States in terms of their overall power in this region. The US remains a globally dominant player, but China obviously has its advantages in its near abroad. And there is a leveling taking place between two superpowers.
Hervé, can I interrupt you there, if I may?
Sorry, yeah, of course.
Is a point of convergence a very polite way of saying the Chinese are catching up or the Americans are falling back?
Yes, exactly. And it's alternated between years. So what we saw last year was the Chinese were catching up. What we see this year is that the US is falling behind. But the effect is that the power differential between the United States and China has narrowed by half in the space of 2 years.
But let me ask you about that as an American. Yeah. You noted that last year it looked like the Chinese were accelerating. This year it looks like the United States is slowing down. What is it about the last year that has led the United States to slow down or to fall back?
Yeah, well, look, the US remains the most powerful country in our region, but it registered the largest fall in relative power of any country in 2020. And it's really been driven by a number of variables, some of which we've already seen. The fact is the Trump administration's emphasis on renegotiating trade agreements and rebalancing trade flows one country at a time has really not really kept pace with Chinese economic soft power, if that's what we want to call it, or Chinese economic diplomacy. And the US has lost the most points in the measures in which China is already ahead. So the US, remains the military power in the region. It's got the best developed defense networks. It has the most cultural influence. On the other hand, China is ahead in terms of its economic diplomacy, in terms of its economic resources, its market size in Asia, and in terms of diplomatic influence. Even though China has also emerged diminished from this crisis, it has not emerged as diminished as the United States. So that is really what's driving this. And I think the point is that the pandemic has also resulted in a loss of prestige for the US in this region. America suffered the largest reputational hits for its domestic and international handling of the COVID-19 pandemic. And this is according to a number of surveys. So most of our indicators are quantitative, but we've got a dozen that rely on expert surveys. We ask a geographically balanced group of policymakers from the region to give us their assessments of how they perceive power and prestige. And I think the result is a powerful reminder that legitimacy and leadership on the world stage starts with the capacity of leaders to govern well at home. And it testifies in equal measure to, I think, the consequences of a failure in global leadership.
Are you saying that the US response to coronavirus seems to suggest a lack of confidence?
Yeah, that's certainly how it's read in this region, according to our expert surveys. Now, I should also underline that China has also suffered reputational setbacks, but its performance legitimacy, is the academic speak for this. Its performance legitimacy is intact because it's ruthlessly suppressed this virus. On the other hand, I think many of the reasons why people view the China model with suspicion, its authoritarian reflexes, have only been reinforced. That wariness has been reinforced. And so it has actually lost lost some diplomatic standing in the region. And I mean, the rise of Wolf Warrior diplomacy, the leveling of economic threats against economic partners like Australia, the outright skirmishes on the border with India, all that has contributed to China looking like its diplomatic power has fallen and its overall power is largely stalled, which is, I think, an interesting case study because the previous years we've done this, China has always been rising. This is the first year that China has actually remained unchanged. And I think what it does is it highlights both the strengths and weaknesses, the enduring weaknesses that continue to afflict China as it becomes the region's second superpower.
What does the power index say about some of the other significant countries in the region? I'm thinking, for example, Japan.
So beneath China and the US sits two major powers, that's how we describe them, Japan and India. Now, it's interesting because in the same way that the US's strengths are China's weaknesses and vice versa, Japan and India look like mirror images of each other. They're obviously far more aligned, geopolitically speaking, but in terms of where they draw their strengths, where they draw their power from, Japan is this quintessential smart power in the sense that it uses limited resources to the best possible effect in producing broad-based influence, whether that's diplomatic or cultural, or in terms of its economic diplomacy in Southeast Asia. So it's highly networked, it's well-liked in the region, but it is in structural decline. It's an advanced economy that's aging rapidly, low productivity, and so it's losing ground in relation to some of the larger economies. Now, India is the inverse image of that. India is this market of 1 billion people. It's set to outgrow China's population in the next couple of years. And it draws its strengths from its scale and its potential as well. So I think in Australia, there's a great hope that India, as the only country that can match China in demographic terms, and as a democracy, has the potential to create a sort of counterbalance to China. But that will require India to continue to develop economically. The pandemic has set that back. In fact, when we forecast India's GDP by the end of this decade, by 2030, when we did that last year, we were forecasting that India's economic output would be about 50% of China's by the end of this decade. But as a result of this pandemic, it may only be 40%. So the power differential between India and China has actually increased. And so that has delayed India's arrival as a great power. On top of that, it's made some good progress in terms of its defense diplomacy. That's an area of historical weakness for India. It's traditionally been non-aligned, but we have seen some significant changes in its posture and willingness to engage the United States, but also Japan and Australia through the quadrilateral grouping. And we've seen improvements in its diplomatic influence score. It's outranked Moscow and Seoul this year for diplomatic influence. New Delhi has. But in terms of its economic diplomacy, this is where it really lags. I mean, India remains a very insular, protectionist economy. It's fallen further behind in regional trade integration efforts. It's decided to withdraw from the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, which is the largest free trade agreement being negotiated. There's only one free trade agreement bigger than that, and that's the World Trade Organization. And India, you know, would have played a critical role within that. And it's decided to withdraw from that. So it is a shame. And I think Australia invests a lot of hope in India, but we also realize that we need to see India on its own terms. Its rise is not linear, and it has obviously some very distinct characteristics, which will continue to present a weakness in terms of its ability to engage a region economically.
Okay, so you see Japan as a country that is essentially an overachiever. I think the index actually uses that phrase. It's structurally declining, but its influence in some sense is greater than one would predict on the basis of its resources. It's, I guess, use an American phrase, punching above its weight. India was a country that looked like it was starting to sort of gain momentum and to accelerate, but seems to have stalled out this year. What about some of the other countries in Asia? One that obviously comes to mind for Americans of a certain age, which would be Russia, which, I mean, we tend to think of it as a European power, but, you know, Russia is a huge country, spans all the way from, you know, Poland to the Pacific, Bering Sea, long border with China, also touches on North Korea. So where does Russia come out in all of this?
Yeah, well, in my limited discussions with Russian officials, and actually, this is through the grapevine, I haven't actually directly engaged with them on this at all. A colleague at the UN mentioned that they had spoken about the Asia Power Index with a Russian diplomat who was not happy because we classify Russia as a middle power and not a major power.
Oh, that's not going to make people in the Kremlin happy.
Yeah, that's right. But I think the point is, I mean, this exercise is about power in Asia, and Russia is a bit of a misfit middle power in our region. it is, you're quite right, a Eurasian power. It has its Pacific fleet in Vladivostok. It has a number of quite interesting defense consultation pacts with not only China, but also North Korea, Vietnam, and India. And this was actually an initiative out of the first term of Vladimir Putin, where he sort of revived these old Soviet era treaties. But Russia, I think, is also and remains also the biggest arms provider to the region, bigger than the US, bigger than China. But it is quite sort of mercenary. And increasingly, its foreign policy in Asia is also at odds with the fact that it's a much closer partner to China. And so, for example, if Russia has good relations with Vietnam and Russian oil firms want to discover some oil fields in the South China Sea, which happens to be contested between Vietnam and China, they get caught up in these awkward exchanges. And ultimately, I think Russia is increasingly beholden to China, and it's the junior partner in that relationship. And its foreign policy in Asia, the ability to conduct an independent foreign policy that's with a number of other players, including India and Vietnam, has really, I think, suffered as a result of the strengthening partnership with China. So ultimately, it's become the energy provider for China. There is a sort of agreement, I would think, to share power in Central Asia and for China to have the prerogative in Asia and for Russia to have the prerogative in the Middle East and Europe. And I think they've sort of divided. I mean, it's a gross exaggeration, but I think that there's kind of this unstated agreement between them that that's how their partnership works. And that's where, you know, so Russia is a strange player in this region, but it's still a member of the East Asia Summit. It still prides itself as a sort of global power. And so it wants to have an Asia-based presence and foreign policy in its own right. But increasingly, I think it's a legacy of a previous time in which it was a much bigger player.
What about a different country in Northeast Asia, and that's North Korea? Russia, let's talk about both Koreas.
Yeah, well, it's really interesting. I mean, North Korea is obviously a power that's chosen to put all its eggs in one basket, which is in terms of its both its conventional military strength and then also in terms of its nuclear weapons. And that means that it has, you know, a high degree of deterrence. It can often command the headlines. But we shouldn't forget its GDP is smaller than Laos, even though it has a population that's about four times the size of Laos. And Laos is one of the poorest countries in Southeast Asia. So it has really fallen back. It's particularly isolated in this region, and so on all the other measures of influence, it really flatlines. And if the point of this assessment is to look at all-rounders, countries that can perform across a variety of different power-based measures and broad-based influence, then I think North Korea doesn't it just clearly doesn't do so well. But if the point is that, you know, North Korea is, you know, has an incredible deterrence capacity and in that sense is probably better defended than South Korea, it depends on what you're looking at and what your aim is, what you hope to achieve geopolitically. Now, South Korea is another interesting one because this year, actually, Australia overtook South Korea as the sixth most powerful country in the Indo-Pacific. South Korea is a peninsular power. It's very focused on the state of affairs in relation to North Korea. It's obviously very vulnerable to what happens there. It has gotten stuck in recent years in between US-China competition. I think you remember the controversy surrounding the THAAD missile defense deployments in South Korea.
Couldn't miss it.
Yes, and the consequences that it had for South Korea's businesses in China. So South Korea is looking to diversify its economic relationships. It's got a new southbound policy, like many countries in our region. That is to say, they want to invest in Southeast Asia and further afield and try to lessen their dependence on the Chinese market. But it's very hard to achieve that. On top of which, they also have a very strange relationship with the US. It's not as close as the Japan-US alliance. And South Korea doesn't play the same sort of pan-regional role that you would see Japan play, for example. I mean, Japan is a far more strategic player. It's reached out to India. It's committed to this Indo-Pacific strategy. There's too much that complicates the US-South Korea relationship that, and I think South Korea increasingly sees itself as non-aligned or wants to take a slightly more equidistant approach between China and the US. And on top of that, it has a very difficult relationship with Japan, which means it's not fallen into the fold of these defense partnerships that we've seen emerging between Japan and India and the US and Australia. It's just not really that active in that area.
So, Hervé, you indulge me by talking about where America stood in the Asia Power Index. I want to give you a chance to talk about your hometown team. So tell me about Australia. You mentioned that it has surpassed South Korea, but give us sort of a fuller picture of Australia's place in the region and in the index.
Yeah, sure. So I think this is really my arch thesis, and feel free to criticize it. It might be overly optimistic, but I think that in a situation where neither the United States nor China can assert primacy in our region, or at least undisputed primacy in our region, and that looks like that will stay. So even though we're predicting that, you know, China will level with the US at some point this decade, we don't think China will meaningfully pull ahead of the US. It has too many weaknesses. It's also an aging society. We can go into that later. But what that means is that in a situation where neither of the superpowers can really dominate the region, the actions and the choices and the interests of smaller players, including middle powers like Australia, become more consequential. They will make the marginal difference in the regional balance of power. And it is interesting that of the 26 countries we looked at this year, only three registered gains in their relative power in 2020. And they were Vietnam, Australia, and Taiwan. All very different, but all middle powers. Now, Taiwan comes from a very vulnerable base. It's not ranked particularly highly, but it is interesting. It gained in its reputation. And so did Australia and so did Vietnam. Now, that was a necessary, you know, doing well in terms of handling the pandemic was a necessary but not sole condition for improving their regional standing. We actually think that the performances of all three highlights how the future is likely to be defined by, it's another heavy term, asymmetric multipolarity.
A lot of syllables there.
That's right. That at the margins, middle powers like Australia, even though they can't dictate the regional order, they can still influence it, and they are playing more active roles. Now, what we've seen Australia do particularly well this year is in terms of its cultural influence. That might perhaps seem a bit strange because we're a diverse society, but primarily still kind of Western. But on the other hand, we've expanded the geographical scope of the index to include Papua New Guinea. Now, you might think, well, what is that? You know, where is that? But Papua New Guinea is actually a very interesting country that sits on the geographical continuum of Asia, Southeast Asia, and our Pacific near abroad. It has a land border with Indonesia, and it's also increasingly contested between China and Australia. And what we've seen is that Australia has enormous influence, cultural and otherwise, in its Pacific near abroad. And so we've captured that to a greater extent this year by including Papua New Guinea. But where Australia does best is in terms of its defense diplomacy. Now, that is a reflection of a historical alliance with the United States, which remains incredibly deep and robust, but it is also a consequence of Australia's investment in non-allied defense partnerships. And this is increasingly what drives defense diplomacy in our region. And Canberra has led the way in forging bilateral, trilateral, quadrilateral, quad plus, you could call it variable geometry, defense partnerships with a diverse range of countries, including India and Japan and Vietnam and others. And what we see is that actually Australia is ranked ahead of the United States, despite a far more modest military capability. It's ranked ahead of the United States for its capacity to exercise defense diplomacy with non-allied partners in the region. So we think that Australia carries less great power baggage, and it's demonstrated that it can be far nimbler than its US ally in creating these kinds of defense networks, which are increasingly important as a sort of strategic and military counterweight to China.
Now, Hervé, when I look at the index and the rankings, one thing that jumps out at me, besides the trends you've noted before, most notably China closing the gap on the United States, is that most of the countries, let's say in your top 10, top dozen, are countries that are very friendly with the United States and not necessarily terribly friendly with China. Or to put it this way, those countries may be concerned about America's reliability or its competence, but they're not fearful of the United States. Whereas as they look at or look toward Beijing, they're worried about Chinese assertiveness or aggressiveness or appetite. So in sort of thinking about America's role in the region, is it the case that the United States has a structural advantage over China, given that it has plenty of friends and allies and partners in Asia in a way that China doesn't? Or am I reading too much into your findings?
No, you're absolutely right. So that's another key point of the index is that, you know, the strength, the number and the depth of partnerships in the region, you might call it network power, is ultimately what will decide, you know, who prevails. And the fact is that, you know, China has obviously enhanced its military capability. It's invested in weaponry that can now threaten US and allied bases in the region. And there's no doubt, you know, political will and defense economics will be deciding factors in the military rivalry between the US and China. China. However, it is not just about the US and China, as you quite rightly point out. There are 11 neighbors of China with whom it has boundary disputes or legacies of interstate conflicts, or both in the case of India. And that really undermines, I think, the potential for Beijing to ever really even think to replace Washington as a security guarantor in the region. Now, there are a number of exceptions to that rule, Cambodia being one of them, Pakistan another. They kind of adopt a kind of your enemy's enemy is your friend approach. So Cambodia has beef against Vietnam. Vietnam's neighbor is China. Pakistan has problems with India. Obviously, that means that China is a natural ally. But this is going to be a pronounced weakness for China. And it is a source of comparative strength for the United States as an external strategic balancer.
Now, I'll note that our conversation is going to be posted on November 3rd, which is Election Day here in the United States. And I'm just curious, as you look forward to the next edition of the Asia Power Index, how do you anticipate that the election here in the United States could change the results of the index a year from now when we have you back on the president's inbox to sort of update us on what you're seeing in the region? That is, will it matter if President Trump is reelected or if he is defeated and Joe Biden becomes president? Is the index that sensitive to elections, or are there just too many bigger flows going on influencing the results?
No. I think it's always that combination of structural factors and political choices, right? And in fact, a lot of the reasons for this decline in U.S. standing in our region boil down to political choices made over the last 4 years. And there's a real tangible possibility that can be reversed. And, you know, narratives change quickly, reputations can be regained. But I think there's an expectation in the region that there's no status quo ante here. There's no return to what we previously enjoyed, where the U.S. unipolar moments in this region is well and truly over. We have to accept this is a bipolar region. And I think the US, one way or the other, has to learn to walk and chew gum at the same time. That means you've got to be tough on China and engage in intense strategic rivalry, but also cooperate where necessary and invest in partnerships. And so there is a real sense, maybe hope might be too strong a word, but I think, you know, that things might be changing for the United States. Now, where the structural picture comes in is simply that regardless of who wins the election, the fact is there's going to be an uneven sequencing of economic recoveries. China has already rebounded in 2020. It may take several years before before the United States reaches its pre-COVID levels of economic output. That's not a problem unique to the United States. It's a problem for many advanced economies, including Japan and Australia. But that in itself will shake things up here and leave a lasting legacy. So quite apart from the reputational gains and losses of the pandemic, the long-lived effects will probably be in terms of the race to economic recoveries. And the fact is, we think that China will, its centrality to the kind of political economy of this region will continue to grow as a result of the fact that it's rebounded faster than anyone else. And so we have to accept as well that I think globalization will continue to evolve to involve both China and the US, even if they do less with each other. So even with decoupling and a broad-based new Cold War, but this will mean a more hazardous variant of globalization for the region, potentially more dominated by spheres of economic influence. And so, you know, this is why it's important that we also invest in multilateral trade agreements, because they offer a multilateral hedge against China's asymmetric economic clout in this region. So we really need to see the US invest not only in terms of its defense partnerships, but also in terms of trying to beef up the economic rules-based order in this region. And that is something that we'll be looking for in the next administration, whoever that may be.
On that note, I'll close up the president's inbox for this week. My guest has been Hervé Lemahieu, director of the Asian Power and Diplomacy Program at the Lowy Institute, which is located in Sydney, Australia. You can find the 2020 Asia Power Index at power.lowyinstitute.org, and that's Lowy, L-O-W-Y. Hervé, as always, thanks for joining me.
Thank you, Jim. It's always a pleasure.
Please subscribe to the President's Inbox on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen, and leave us a review. They help us get noticed and improve the show. As always, opinions expressed in the President's Inbox are solely those of the host or our guest, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's episode was produced by Zoe Collins with senior producer Jeremy Sherlock. Zoe doubled as our recording engineer and helped us get through a number of annoying technical problems. So thank you, Zoe. Special thanks go out to Margaret Gatch for her assistance. This is Jim Lindsay. Thanks for listening.